We have Jake Conroy from the Shack 7, who I think I talked to you guys a little bit about before the film started, and Ben Rosenfeld, who's an attorney working on Green Scare cases. So we're going to hear first from Jake, and then from Ben, and then Dennis and I will come back for a brief Q&A. So.
And, you know, I'd just like to say this film is about people who do break the law for animal liberation, and would be considered members of the ALF. Jake and his co-defendants were sent to prison for doing what most people in this country would consider to be protected First Amendment activity, namely running a website and organizing protests, and basically served time for the actions of others because they were the only people the government could find. So that's a little background. If you're not familiar with Jake's case, you can read about the Shack 7 online, and we're really honored to have him here.
Hi, how you doing? As Casey said, my name's Jake, and I'm a member of the Shack 7. The Shack 7 basically is six individuals and one organization who did their part in organizing the campaign against Huntington Life Sciences, which is a notorious animal testing laboratory based in New Jersey and in England. And basically what happened was the government implied that because we ran an above-ground protest campaign and organized protests, as well as reported on legal demonstrations, as well as underground direct actions on our webpage, that we were conspiring with others, meaning anyone on the internet, anyone in here, to engage in those illegal activities and encouraging those illegal activities by simply reporting and editorializing on them. So they charged us on a variety of charges, including one that was talked about in the movie called the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, as well as it's been renamed since then to the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And we were charged with those. We went to trial for about a month, and we unfortunately lost our case, and we were all sentenced to a variety of prison sentences. I was sentenced to 48 months in federal prison. I served 37 months in two federal prisons in Southern California, and 6 months in a federal halfway house in Oakland, California, and now I'm working on my first of 3 years of federal probation. So it's been kind of a long road. But of the two prisons that I was housed in, the first one was in Victorville, California, and it was basically what you'd expect from a federal prison. It's, you know, what you'd see in the movies. There was a lot of fights and riots and stabbings and gang politics and racial politics. And it basically exemplified everything you could think of when you think of a federal prison. And there was one officer there who also kind of exemplified what you think of when you think of a prison guard. He was kind of this big old guy, could barely keep his pants on. He had his head shaved, and he had this big long goatee that he would twirl into horns. And he used to walk around with this spit cup and a big wad of dip, and he'd walk around and he didn't take crap from anyone. And you didn't mess with him, and he was more than certainly going to mess with you. And one day I was walking to the rec yard about 8 o'clock in the morning, and there was a fight off by the chow hall, and there was about five or six guys, and they're beating up this one guy, then I'm on the ground. And those kind of situations, if it doesn't involve you, you don't pay it any attention. You know, you can't, because you know, you get yourself in trouble. So you just kind of have to ignore it and pretend like it's not happening. You kind of keep an eye on it out of the corner of your eye, just making sure there's not going to be any problems that are going to involve you. And you also don't want to draw any attention to the police that there's a fight going on, because again, that creates a problem for yourself. So I'm just kind of slowly passing by and keeping my eye on things. And the alarm sounds, which basically is someone has seen one of the guards has seen something, and they've hit the alarm, and all available cops come rushing in to break up the fight. So the alarm sounds, and all these cops are running from all over the prison, and you know, I'm just kind of walking along, and I look over across the yard, and here comes this officer that we had basically deemed, we called an Alabama State Trooper, because that's just, you know, what we thought an Alabama State Trooper would look like, you know, with the big old Burt Reynolds glasses and everything. So he's coming running across the yard, and I was like, oh man, that guy's really moving fast, you know? And he's coming at me, and he comes up to me, and I'm in his way apparently, and he just says, get out of my way, Mary, you know? And he pushes me aside, and I'm thinking, did this guy just call me Mary? But oddly enough, like, sitting here tonight and thinking about today, I thought about Alabama State Trooper, and I'll tell you why in a few minutes. But, you know, I'm often asked what got me involved in activism, and unfortunately I don't have like a really big aha story or a big epiphany story where it just kind of hit me one moment and the next thing, you know, I'm this activist. It was kind of a very long, winding process starting when I was a little kid that revolved around a lot of media, you know, books and magazines and movies and music. And I remember as a little kid, I used to go to my elementary school library and read about the civil rights movement. And I'd go to the public library and get all the books I possibly could on the civil rights movement. I'd have my nose buried and I'm reading them. And I grew up in New England in the suburbs, which is, you know, it's very white and very middle and upper class. And so I read a lot about Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King and freedom riders and all of that, and which is great, but it's not the whole story. You know, and it wasn't until I was 14, and not to date myself here, but I go down to the record store called Record Town, where they actually still sold records in a national chain, and I bought this record called The Fear of a Black Planet by Public Enemy. And I brought it home, and I put it on, and it, you know, blew my mind. You know, they're rapping and singing about, you know, black liberation and black power and Malcolm X and Huey Newton and the Panthers, and I never heard any of that stuff before, and it hit me. I'm like, wow, like there's more to this story, you know? And so time goes on, and I start getting involved in activism around 95, and I get this VHS tape in the mail, you know, this photocopied cover of this documentary called All Power to the People, which hopefully some of you guys got a chance to see. And if you haven't, it's hard to find and hard to get your hands on, but if you can, like, definitely please watch it. So I get this documentary, and I put it in, and it blew my mind again, like, you know, seeing Bobby Seale talk about starting the Panthers and patrolling Oakland and all these amazing activists doing these really radical things that I never really thought about and didn't really know existed in the world. You know, I'd started to get a glimpse of that in the animal rights community, but I didn't know it really existed anywhere else. It was powerful to me. You know, it really hit a chord. And what besides just the imagery of these people walking around with, you know, guns patrolling other cops and how amazing that was, it was also the idea that they were running breakfast programs where they were feeding more kids across the country before school that were hungry than the United States government was. That they were inoculating people against sickle cell anemia in their communities more than the U.S. government was. They were doing food drives and clothes drives. And supporting their communities, and they were reaching out to other organizations and other movements, like the Brown Berets and the American Indian Movement, and teaching them, and in return they were teaching each other, and growing, and utilizing this community support, and understanding that they were kind of reaching out and using every tool in the toolbox, and thinking outside of the box to come up with these really radical and amazing solutions to some really big problems. And they were being really successful. And so I tried to adopt some of that into my own activism. When I was working with Shaq, we would often do, we'd think about these ways of thinking outside of the box and trying to utilize every tool in the toolbox, or at least supporting the idea of that. And like I said, we published a lot of stuff on our webpage, a lot of reports of protests, both legal and illegal. And we published a lot of articles that the media printed about us that said we were thugs and extremists and terrorists. But the idea was that every tactic and every tool had an opportunity to work or an opportunity to fail, but we didn't know. You know, no one's really can sit down and say, well, this would work and this wouldn't, because at the end of the day, we really don't know. And it's really not up to, we felt it really wasn't up to us to censor, you know, some people and not the other. And maybe that's what ended up getting us into a lot of trouble. But it was the idea that we should all be working together, and we might not agree with each other, or we might not agree with each other's tactics, but together we can be this really unified front. And so what we would do is, about once a year, we would organize these national demonstrations against some sort of target, against the laboratory or the laboratory itself. And we'd have people flying from all over the country. You know, we'd have several hundred people show up. And we'd have a day of like a big national demonstration where people would protest against the laboratory or one of its affiliates. And then we'd have a day of like home demonstrations where little groups of people would split up all over the region and, you know, and do demonstrations all over. And then we would do a day of like networking and speeches and talks. And so it provided an opportunity for everyone to come together and meet and also hear some really inspirational speakers. But we always wanted to make sure that those speakers represented a broad range of activism. And so one time in New Jersey, we had a variety of people come speak. We had Robin Webb come over from England, and he spoke about his time as the Animal Liberation Front press officer in England. We had Rod Coronado speak about not only his animal and earth liberation struggles, but also the struggle for his people. He's a Native American activist. And we also had Bobby Seale come, who you may have seen in the movie, who is a co-founder of the Black Panther Party, come and speak about his issues and the oppression that they faced and how they may relate to what, you know, us as activists were going through at the time and continue to go through today. So when we announced this lineup, we started getting these angry emails from people that were saying, well, how dare you have Bobby Seale come speak? Because in the 80s, he published a cookbook, a barbecuing cookbook, and to raise money for a nonprofit. And people were emailing us, well, how dare you have this guy who cooks animals and supports the killing of animals come speak to animal rights activists and vegans? And, you know, our obviously rebuttal is like, well, you know, we can't all be 100% the same. It'd be great for everyone to be vegan, but this guy has such a vast knowledge of radical history and oppression, and he's a really valuable person to embrace and accept. And so people would say, you know, well, I'm not coming. I'm not coming to this event. I'm not coming to the whole weekend. I'm boycotting the whole thing, which to me was ridiculous. I mean, beyond just the very principles of the talk here, but for people to say, you know, I'm not going to come to these demonstrations, I'm not going to be a supportive member of this community because of one person that's showing up I happen to disagree with. So obviously, you know, Bobby Seale was coming, and that was that. But he flew out here on his own dime from Oakland into New Jersey, and he came to the event. He set up his table with his wife and was selling his books. And in walks one of these guys that we knew had a real problem with Bobby Seale being there. And we're like, oh boy, you know, here we go. So he walks in, and he heads straight for their table. But what he's doing is he was carrying a big stack of books. And he had every book, you know, that you could think of. He had Diet for New America by John Robbins. He had Free the Animals by Ingrid Newkirk, and every book in between that talked about the issues. And he went up to Bobby Seale, and he gave him the books. You know, he must have spent a couple $100 on these books and gave them to him. And spent about 20, 30 minutes talking to the Seals about the issue. And I thought, you know, that's a really creative and interesting way to deal with this issue, and I hadn't thought of it. I wish I had, but I don't know. I was really impressed by him and by both of them, you know, by the presenter of the books and Bobby Seale, and how they both kind of handled that situation. It was kind of a neat experience, and something that I don't know. I often think about when thinking about bridging communities and gaps in those communities. Which brings me back to the Guard, Alabama State Trooper, back at Victorville. And the reason why I've been thinking about him today. When he arrived there, they put him in the visiting room. Like, he was in charge of the visiting room for that quarter, and that meant he oversaw the visiting room and he enforced the rules and how the rules were going to be enforced. And the visiting room in prison is like the crown jewel of room in prison. Like, that's the one place where an inmate gets to go and be themselves again, where their family gets to come and their loved ones and their partners and their friends and their kids can come and get to spend time with them. And it's, you know, it's a special time. You get to hug your family, you get to give them a kiss, you get to sit next to them and eat some food and hold hands and talk for 8 hours. And it's something that you don't ever want to have taken away from you, because then that's it. Like, you're done. So, and a lot of these people, you have to remember, at Victorville were doing 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. They're doing life sentences, and they might get a visit once or twice a year if they're lucky. And to have that taken away from them is huge. I mean, you really couldn't get much bigger than that. And so when Alabama State Trooper was in there, he started taking away all the rules. You no longer could kiss your family hello. You couldn't hold their hands through the visit. You couldn't give them a hug. He closed the room where inmates could go and play with their kids, you know, supervised by a guard. He closed all that down. And people were getting really furious, you know. And if he saw you kissing someone, you know, which was allowed, He assumed that you two were swapping or passing drugs orally, you know, through your mouth, which does happen. But he assumed that anyone engaging in a kiss was you know, guilty of this. So he would take you and put you in solitary confinement in what they call a dry room, where basically it's a little cell with no waste disposal. There's no toilet, there's no sink, and they give you a bucket with the idea that you're going to pass through the drugs eventually, and then they look through the bucket, and then they can charge you. So obviously, as you can imagine, this got pretty intense pretty quick. People weren't really going to stand for it. And so in my unit alone, there was a handful, or a bunch of us, that were really upset. But like I said, in prison, everything is racially segregated, not by the guards, but by the inmates. So even the littlest things, there's rules about. You know, certain races can't eat with certain races. You can't share certain things. You can't live or sell with a certain race. You can't, you know, mix these types of races together, like whites don't do this with the blacks, and blah, 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 blah. And so you can't do anything together. But people were so furious about this guy and how he was ruining our visiting room, basically. So myself and a couple other people in my unit got together, a big group of us, about 15 people that represented all the races that were there. We had a few white guys and a few black guys and Native Americans and Pacific Islanders and Sereños, which are Southern California gang members from Central and South America, and so forth and so on. And we all decided that we're all going to go together as like this unified front to go down and do something about this. So at lunchtime in prison, they call it mainline, where they have everyone lines up, all, you know, like the warden and the assistant warden, all these important people come out, and you get your 5 minutes to, you know, give your spiel or complain about something, and they nod and send you along. And so we're like, all right, they're all out there at mainline, let's go down and talk to them. So there's like 15 of us, and we're all strolling through, walking down the main line, and, you know, we're all together, all racially mixed, you know. When something in prison happens that's out of the ordinary, even if it's the smallest thing, everyone knows about it immediately. It really is, you can cut the tension with a knife. And everyone's like, what the hell is going on here? You know what I mean? Because we got like 15 guys, and we're marching down there, and you can see the warden, and he's like, something's going on here. And so the warden's standing there, and then yeah, as we get closer, we can see the captain. He saddles up next to the warden, and then the assistant warden saddles up next to him, and a lieutenant and a couple of guards, and then like the unit manager and the case manager, and we all roll up, you know, all of us, and of course there's me, like the little scrawny, like, you know, vegan kid up front, like, hey! And so we go up to this warden, and this warden is, he doesn't mess around. I mean, Victorville is a serious prison, and he didn't take any crap from anyone. He's one of the few people that I can think of outside of the military that has a high-ranking administrative job that still wears camouflage to the workplace. And so he rolls up, or we roll up on him, and we start saying, you know what, like, this is out of control. You have the situation in the visiting room. We're all here, and we're all really pissed off. And, you know, we gave him a spiel and said, something's got to happen. And it was the first and only time that I saw him in the warden's eyes. And he's been through riots and everything. And he was like, he took notice, you know, and I could see it in his eyes. He was like, these people mean business, and they're unified, which I've never seen before, so something serious is going on here, and I got to look into it. And he said, you know what, I'm going to handle it, don't worry about it. And that's all he said, and we just went, okay, and we didn't know what to do. I mean, we expected, like, a lot of opposition to it, and so we're like, all right, so we all just left, and sure enough, the next week, Alabama State Trooper was not in the visiting room. And then several weeks later, he was removed from the compound altogether and moved to an administrative position out of the back. So that was really, I don't know, it was one of those times when you're in this really bizarre situation. You know, you're in prison, and you're looking around, and you're seeing, like, this unification, these people coming together in really odd circumstances. And it was really exciting. It was really inspirational to me. And that's kind of why I think about Alabama State Trooper, you know, as I sit here tonight, because for that brief moment in prison, we all took this plunge together. We kind of bridged the gaps and the barriers and took some risks. And we accomplished something pretty cool, you know. And it may have been a fleeting moment when you're in prison, but, you know, it was important. Getting that boost was exciting. And so it reminds me, as well as this movie, Bold Native, and the movie before, All Power of the People, about how important it is to use every tool in the toolbox, to use our resources and to learn from one another. Because we're all here and we have this really amazing opportunity. And the amazing opportunity is that we live in the Bay Area, which is, I'm having a hard time thinking any place else in America that has such a rich history of radical activism and revolutionary spirit. We have decades and decades of activists of all levels, of all different varieties, that have done some really amazing work. Claude Marx spoke previously, hopefully some of you got to see him. He works with Freedom Archives, he's a great guy. And to me, he's more than just an activist. He's such an inspiration to me because as someone that's been in prison and has gotten out and it's been, you know, it's daunting at times, you know, to think, well, what do I do next? You know, what can I possibly do? And you start feeling burnout. And as activists, I think we all feel burnout sometimes, or even just in our daily lives, besides activism, we feel a lot of burnout. And we just, it's almost to the point where we're giving up. But you look at people like Claude Marx, or you look at people like Richard Brown, and the people, the SFA, that here they are decades later, and they're still struggling for revolutionary change. And they're still active. And it might not be what they were doing before, but they're still active in the movement and in the struggle. And it's such an inspiration to me. But besides an inspiration, it's also this really neat opportunity because we can learn from them. And we can learn so much from them. And on the flip side, they want to learn as well. So as this younger generation, we have this really great opportunity to get to teach to them and work together and grow in this struggle together. Because we all might be fighting for different things, be it animal liberation or earth liberation or human liberation. We all want the same thing at the end, and that's liberation. We want revolutionary change. And in order to do that, we need to think outside of the box. And we need to realize that we may have our differences. Some of us might be vegan. Some of us might write barbecue and cookbooks. But we have something to teach one another and to learn from one another and to grow from one another. And we can make these really exciting changes, even in today's scary political climate. But in order to do that, we really need to make sure that we do it together. So, thank you. There's a donation jar outside for Marie Mason, who's a political prisoner. She was indicted and thrown in prison for 22 years for a variety of earth and animal liberation activity. And she basically allegedly was doing these things with her husband. Her husband got caught for something small and got scared and ratted out his own wife. And on the day that she was arrested, he divorced her. And so now she's serving 22 years in prison in Texas, I think. And her two kids, young kids, are still living in the Midwest. She doesn't get to see them very often. So we're just trying to raise some money. She's also a vegan, and she's having a tough time getting vegan food. So we're raising money to put on our commissary, help her get some vegan food, and to show some support. So there's more information about her out there. There's some Bold Native merchandise and a donation jar from Marie Mason. So if you can help out, that'd be great. And here's Ben.
Hi, if you guys need to leave, that's fine. I understand everybody's been here a long time. And I actually don't want to give a lot of prepared remarks, if that's okay. I'll just take some questions. I mean, I'm a lawyer. If I talk for 5 minutes, I can talk for an hour. And, I mean, there is a green scare. I thought Jake hit most of the kind of major notes. I'm really glad to hear him couple the sort of issues of struggle. Some of the best resistance we've seen has been in the solidarity campaigns between animal rights and some of the black liberation, sort of secondary black liberation struggles in terms of the responses to grand jury harassment in San Francisco. There's a great model of this when those two camps were facing grand jury harassment a few years ago. I don't want to suggest that it's one struggle, but certainly there's a lot of commonality. There is a green scare. It does take the form of a latter-day COINTELPRO dirty tricks campaign and witch hunt by the federal government. One of the things I've done as a lawyer is to catalog a lot of the things that they've said, meaning you know various officials, in their sort of unguarded moments that do tend to reveal or confirm that they are engaged in a deliberate campaign to essentially dismantle radical movements. They've even, Robert Mueller, the director of the FBI, has even used that term. I mean, things that that they used to get spanked for, that they used to be ashamed of. In a sense, unfortunately, 9/11, among the many things it means, it also apparently means not having to apologize for being a fascist anymore. I've been involved in most of the Green Scare cases as a lawyer in one form or another. I'm a little bit chagrined to admit that Shaq wasn't one of them. The Shaq folks just really took a drubbing. Unfortunately, theirs is one of several cases in which people took serious hits for literally engaging in First Amendment activity. I mean, things that most people who've had high school civics in this country would assume are protected activity. And there have been other examples. Rod Coronado is one of them. A kid named Sherman Austin in LA is another example. We've seen others as well. So go ahead and ask me any questions, and then I guess just cut me off when you want, or if you want to merge it into the next Q&A, we can do that too.
Why don't we merge them together, just because we have like 10 or 12 minutes before the next film starts, which hopefully a lot of you are staying for. So if you have any questions for Ben or Jake or myself or Casey, I'm Dennis, I'm the director of the film, Casey's the producer. And also just to say real quick, since you all have been so generous and come here to this this fundraiser, which we really appreciate for the Red Vic, we're selling the DVDs for $10 tonight. They're usually $20, so if you guys want to pick up a DVD, that's how much they are.
They make a good Valentine's present.
You had a question?
I was going to ask Jake, since you were convicted under the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, are there conditions of your probation that are animal related?
Surprisingly, no. There's very little specific things that they've added. Like, I do owe restitution, so I can't open a new line of credit, like that kind of thing. I don't think anyone wants to give me a line of credit anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But no, nothing terribly specific. I mean, obviously, I can't communicate with my co-defendants and that sort of thing. But it's pretty typical federal probation, which is prohibited, but nothing specific.
Yes.
That reminds me of something. I guess this is a question for Ben. Speaking of restitution orders, is it your understanding that those are forever? Do they ever extinguish? Do you know?
I don't know specifically. I wouldn't want to give you specific legal advice, but to the best of my understanding, they don't expire.
That's the best of my understanding as well.
I mean, conceivably, there's some legal move you can make that is akin to like a bankruptcy reorganization. I mean, that's pure speculation, though. But somebody could look into it.
Were you able to get? How is your diet treated in prison?
Vegan diet is not considered a diet, so you basically have to do what you can to get the food. I mean, I stayed vegan the entire time, absolutely. Like, that was my first and foremost priority, but you spend a lot of time thinking about how you're going to get your next meal, essentially. Commissary has a lot of stuff on it that's vegan, but it's not very nutritious. So it's, I ate a lot of rice and bean burritos, basically. But I mean, the great and interesting thing about prison is that everything is bought and sold there. If you can think of it, you can get it. I mean, you want to shoot heroin and drink a fifth of Jack Daniels while you're getting a tattoo, like, that could totally happen. and I've seen it happen. But yeah, so getting some vegetables is, I was able to do it.
Is there a garden?
I'm sorry?
Is there a garden there?
No, actually, there's no grass there, so. Yeah, it was in the desert. It was in the Mojave Desert. So, yeah, it was all dirt. But there's no vegan diet whatsoever. Yeah, so you really got to hustle to get it.
Yet other like religious-oriented diets are accommodated.
They recognize like over 130 religions in the Bureau of Prisons, but only really two of them get a special diet, which is Muslim and the Jewish faith. They get what's called common fare diet, which essentially used to be raw vegetables and some bread and some peanut butter, which was great for me, but I didn't qualify because I didn't want to, you know, say I was this religious faith or not. But they're easy to get your hands on. So, but nowadays, actually, they've switched to what's called the national menu, and they no longer offer that option. You basically get, like, a TV dinner of, like, kosher meat as opposed to raw vegetables. But, you know, it's, as I said, everything's bought and sold, so you can find it.
Other questions? Yeah.
Okay, so for the records of the Golden Native, I was really curious to see that there was someone who was being held captive in culture. That's not anything I had ever heard before of any of these type of groups performing. I thought it was interesting that it was in the film. I'm wondering if the purpose of putting it in the film was to actually display something that had actually been replaced or had ever been brought up, or was it just something philosophical?
The answer to that is kind of both. I mean, mostly the latter. Mostly it's the film is a philosophical film. One of Jake's co-defendants, Darius, when he spoke after the film, said that the film's neither a history lesson nor a how-to guide, and I thought that was pretty accurate. It's about ideas, and it's about, like, exploring these different ideologies. As far as, like, the use of physical violence against a person, it's something that hasn't happened in the animal rights movement, certainly in the U.S. There have been cases of attack in the U.K., but again, it wasn't, like, sanctioned. It was, in fact, denounced by the ALF. But in the U.S., it's been a strictly nonviolent movement, and the ALF prohibits it, which is mentioned in the beginning of the film. But there is rhetoric about violence. You know, pretty much every social movement in the history of the world, with the exception of the animal rights movement and the singing revolution, has incorporated some element of violence in it. And like I said, there's also rhetoric about it, you know. And if you look at, like, videos on YouTube of animal abuse, you'll see a lot of comments like, oh God, somebody should kick this guy's ass for what he's doing to the animal. And oftentimes it's for meat eaters. They'll be like, I eat meat, but this is so wrong and disgusting the way they're being treated, somebody should kill them, etc. And so we thought it would, you know, be important to address that sort of idea, and also address the idea of nonviolence in the movement that does exist, which is a tenet of the animal rights movement, which separates it. And when you're telling a story, you can't, you know, a character could just say, oh, we're against violence. But it's a lot more meaningful when Charlie, who represents the movement in the film, actually rejects it in a story manner, you know, by saving the human in the same way he's saving the animals, and saying, we don't engage in an eye for an eye mentality, which is something that certainly our government engages in, you know, with retributive justice and the legal system and everything else. So that was the idea. It was basically to emotionally convey this idea and also address the fact that it is rhetoric, you know, there is rhetoric of violence in this movement like any other movement. But yeah, I mean, I think you know, that's part of why it's a little bit of a fantastical sequence, you know, emotionally, the whole mass and everything else. And we wanted to address the issue of violence and what is violence. And so for us, showing real violence, which is something the movement doesn't engage in, really puts a face on what that is. Because when you say that burning down a building or breaking a cage or stealing an animal that somebody considers property is violence, we think that's a really insulting use of the term. And so it was important to us to show something that would make you physically feel what violence makes one physically feel when you're compassionate, even if it's against somebody that you hate, right? And I think Casey had mentioned the Egypt situation before the last screening, and I think that's a really interesting situation with the way the media has been using the word violence. I keep hearing over and over, nonviolent revolution. The fact is 300 people died in the past couple weeks, but there weren't any buildings burned down. So that's considered nonviolent, even though there's been 300 deaths. It doesn't make much sense to me. So we have this, like, this prioritization of property over human life, and I think that that's something that all these movements, whether it be civil rights movements or movements like in the Middle Eastern countries as they're fighting for democracy, like, can sort of work to make sure that we use the word violence properly. Because I think it's an insult to victims of violence and victims of terrorism when those words get misused. So.
I think
that's my long answer.
It's interesting, too, as we show this film to people who know nothing about animal rights issues or the animal liberation front, etc. It's been that moment in the film where they get behind Charlie, which is which was surprising to us to find out, you know, because I think they didn't understand or connect with Charlie's desire to liberate animals. But when they saw, and a lot of people, I think, outside of the movement think, oh, you just care about animals, you don't really care about people, you don't care about women's rights, blah, 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 blah. I hear that all the time. But when they saw that our hero also cared equally about human liberation, they were like, oh, I get it. So that's been an interesting thing that we didn't expect to find. And nothing like that has ever happened in this movement. So, any other questions? Yes.
I was going to ask one of Ben. Looking at the trajectory of the Green Scare and, you know, and how things have gotten worse since 9/11, do you think that level of, you know, fascism, to use your words, is it hit a plateau? Are there worse things on the horizon? Is, you know, and the, I guess the second part of that question would be, what do you think are some of the most effective ways that people can push back and act against it?
My answer to the first question is easier than the second question. I don't think it's plateaued. I think it's getting worse. I think it's actually dramatically worse under Obama than it was under Bush. You know, you can there could be a lot of discussion about whether that's because Obama is responsible for policies which are actually worse, or just because things were set in motion a while ago. And it, you know, it's kind of like we've drunk the poison and it's still running through our veins. I mean, for one thing, nobody's going to redeem the judiciary anytime soon, which I think at this point is about 60%+ Federalist Society identified federal appellate judges. I mean, people who, for whom it's an article of faith, for example, that the exclusionary rule, the doctrine that if the police obtain evidence illegally, it can't be used against the defendant in court, should just be completely discarded, you know, and it gets worse from there. So, you know, and very recently, under Obama, we've seen, as I'm sure a lot of people in this room know, these Palmer raid-style raids and searches and kind of dragnet-style investigations against various peace activists, people who are working on behalf of Palestinian independence and, to some extent, you know, involved in Colombian issues as well. And I mean, that's one of the most, I mean, without going into great detail about what it entails, it's one of the most pernicious, over-the-top federal police actions that I've seen on my watch. And that's under Obama and Holder. You know, and frankly, I think that should be their Waterloo. I mean, you know, like, who needs Bush if you can have that under Obama? I mean, I hope it turns out that they've whacked a hornet's nest and just aren't prepared for the response. And I hope that, you know, that they alienate a big further chunk of their base and that they're held accountable for that behavior, because it's really disgusting. What are the best things to do about it? You know, I actually think that this law is not the engine of social change anymore the way it used to be during some periods of our history. I actually am one of those people who thinks that working within the system, and I'm not suggesting that people should confine their activities to working within the system, I think that there's actually some ground to be gained legislatively still. I think, you know, frankly, it's an unpopular view in leftist circles, but I think that elective politics is actually still productive. People would really take that responsibility seriously and make, you know, discerning choices at the polls and, you know, walk into a ballot box looking straight ahead and voting their conscience instead of looking left and right, you know, and worrying about how their neighbors are voting. You know, beyond that, I definitely echo what Jake said, that, you know, people have to consider all the tools in the tool shed. I'm not advocating illegal activity, but, you know, certainly I think that principled nonviolent civil disobedience is still an important tool. And I think that, you know, being really vocal and verbal and generating awareness is really important too. Because, you know, if one person steps across the line, then they just get creamed. And if 10 people step across the line, they get hauled off to jail. But if 100 or 1,000 people step across the line, or 10,000 people step across the line, they move the line. And, I mean, we should all be fucking inspired by what happened in Egypt. Because that's not a majority of the population by any stretch. You know, no, I mean, if you think about it, however many tens of thousands of people were in the streets, that's still a tiny fraction of the population of that country, and look what they've just done.
Okay, so I think we should, we need to start the next film, so whoever can get out. Hopefully you'll stay for it. It's awesome. It's a great movie. The runtime is like, I don't know exactly.
It's 80 some minutes, like 82, 83 minutes, 80 minutes, 79 minutes.
Just to give you guys a quick context on the film, those of you who are staying for the film, this movie is based on a novel that was written in the 70s. It was financed by a major studio during the wave of films that they didn't understand and probably didn't watch because they didn't understand them, most of 70s filmmaking. And this in particular, they didn't care about too much because it was in the blaxploitation genre. And the director chose to only send the studio the sex scenes from the movie. So they thought they were getting, you know, as the regular blaxploitation movie. In the meantime, he was making a really subversive satire about the way the government uses minorities for their gains, and the way that minorities can potentially strike back against the government through organizing. And it's a totally subversive, weird film that as soon as it hit the theaters, the studio pulled it, and it hasn't been available for 25 years, seized by the FBI. It's just a lot of fun. So
it was a big inspiration for Bold Native, and it goes great with a vegan cinnamon roll. There's only 10 of them left, though. So
yeah, so $5, we need to start this film soon, but we'll wait like 3 to 5 minutes, and if anybody wants to get concessions, and then start it.
Thank you.
And
there's also great literature. Pick it up on your way out about the grand jury that Ben had spoken about.